y'all too, we're very grateful. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I'll keep my coat on for the time being, but I'm sure it'll warm up. Thank you very much for the kind invitation, and I'm going to come back to maybe listen to the Times correspondent, because correspondents always have a particular view of a situation. My connection with Syria is that I lived there 20 years ago studying Arabic when times were very different. It was Bashar al-Assad's father, and it was a time when Syria was slowly opening up to visitors, tourists, very few. There were mostly, in fact, people who visited the archaeological sites, but there were also students who wanted to study Arabic because Beirut was a bit too international, a bit too French, a bit too much English. Cairo, you could get by in English as well, and Syria was kind of the secret place to go if you wanted to learn proper Arabic. So that's what I did, and as Romy said, after that worked for various organizations in the humanitarian sector. I was asked to kind of set the scene, so to look at, you know, how we got here, what has happened, who's who, what's happening in Syria, and I'm going to try to do that. Syria is a particularly complex conflict. I'm not sure whether it's an entirely new conflict. I think we spoke in the car about Afghanistan in the 80s. I worked in Sudan for a while. I worked in other places in the DRC, Democratic Republic of the Congo. Every conflict is particular in its own way and has a lot of different actors. Having said that, Syria is particular because it has so many different actors. It's very complex, and I think the speed of how things have developed have overwhelmed many of us. So, what I'd like to do is to cover broadly these five areas. So what is happening in Syria now? What is daily life like in Syria? What's the aid response? The refugee crisis, and then a little bit of an outlook, and I think then we'll have time for questions. So, in fact, in a month time, we'll be marking the fifth anniversary, five years into the conflict. So the sixth year will start in mid-March of the conflict. And I was beginning to hope last week when they announced perhaps that there might be a countrywide ceasefire. It was the first time in 5 years that I was a little bit hopeful that perhaps there might be some positive movement. Now, since Monday, recent news, we know that these hopes are pretty much dashed. It's quite often the case in conflicts that one side or several sides will try to win the upper hand militarily to force the other side or the other sides to the negotiating table. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. So the bombing of hospitals on Monday, and we've seen the declarations of Bashar al-Assad saying that he thinks it might be it will be very difficult to implement that ceasefire. But what is actually happening in Syria, and how did we get there? So, just to give you an idea of, you know, Syria, where it is, actually not that far away from here. And what happened in 2011 is that the Arab Spring Revolution or revolts swept through the Middle East. And it surprised many that it came when it came, although many of us who lived in the Middle East knew that at some point it would come. There was a lot of unhappiness, especially the younger generations felt, we have all this wealth. So countries like Tunisia, with a long-standing tourism industry, very wealthy in that respect, other countries as well, Egypt as well, felt we're not benefiting from that. We're being kept quiet. We can't say what we want. We want our voices to be heard. And it was interesting that these revolutions were, in fact, revolutions without a leader. They were very much grassroots movements and very much a youth-led movement. And it was very interesting that, and there, a lot of research was done, people were asking whether these revolutions would have been possible without mobile phones, without today's technology. I was in Cairo during the revolution in 2011, and it was very interesting to see how meetings were set up via Facebook, via text messages. You know, would this have been possible 30 years ago? Not sure. But also what it meant was that news was getting out, and news was getting out from countries, or is getting out from countries like Syria, which traditionally has been very closed. And so what we saw very quickly is Tunisia, you know, Ben Ali very quickly fell, then came Mubarak, within literally 2 months. So Tunisia started, if you remember, November, December. By January, Ben Ali was gone. Mubarak, mid-February. Then came Libya, Gaddafi, probably the most violent of all the Arab Spring revolutions, you know, fell in March. And in the meantime, Syria actually also saw an Arab Spring revolution. But because everybody was so focused on these other countries, I suspect that not a lot of people were paying attention to what was happening in Syria, especially also because Western powers were involved in the bombing of Libya, Western powers together with other Arab countries such as the UAE. And so I think Syria literally passed underneath the radar. And initially it actually looked, and a lot of people hoped, that developments would end up as in the other countries, so that it would be a very quick victory for the masses, that it would, that the regime would fall, that the dictator would cede power. And Bashar al-Assad, in fact, initially did do just that. So he conceded, he made some concessions. So he freed a few prisoners, he made a few concessions to some of the opposition groups. He said they would be able to participate in the political process. But it was only piecemeal. And in fact, what the miscalculation of Bashar al-Assad was, that he thought he could appease, in a way, the masses by giving them a little, underestimating completely what they actually wanted. And so when they weren't happy, what happened was the whole thing became very violent. And so you might remember Daraa, one of the demonstrations became very violent, so there was shooting and civilians died. Now, since then, I would argue that Syria is a conflict of missed opportunities, because I think there was a window of opportunity when this could have gone a different way. And 5 years down the road, you know, we wonder what could Syria have been like if Bashar al-Assad really, genuinely would have said, okay, you know, there is a movement there, I cannot ignore it, how can we move from here in a peaceful way to change Syria? Now, I'm not saying this would have completely been a peaceful way. Usually revolutions, unfortunately, can be violent. But it would have paved the way to something that could have been a lot less violent than what it is now. What happened is that positions became harder and harder, other actors started meddling into that whole conflict, and what we have today is an extremely complex civil war with the involvement of outside forces. So what we have is a constellation of proliferating armed groups. So we've got the Syrian armed forces, we've got so-called moderate, then we've got the more extreme Islamist groups. We have Iranian trained militias. We've got that are loyal to government forces. We've got the Hezbollah. We've got National Defense Forces, which is a loyalist reserve force. And this is even before we're speaking about Islamic State, and even before we're speaking about Western powers getting involved, even before we speak about Russia and Iran getting involved. So what we have today is this. So originally, a civil war. The Syrian government against rebels. Now, very quickly, both sides started to get support from different quarters. So Western powers very early, and I would think that also wasn't helpful, very early on declared, Bashar al-Assad needs to go, we support the rebels, or the opposition. And so on the rebel side, you have the US, Turkey, and Gulf states. On the Syrian side, you've got Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah. And initially, that support was financial, it was political, increasingly with arms, and now troops. Then what you have on top of that is a sectarian war. So Sunni, so Bashar al-Assad comes from a minority sect in a way, which are the Alawis, which are part of the Shia group. And so these are pitted against the Sunni. And the Shiites, Iran is almost 99% Shia, so Iran is providing assistance. Then the Alawites of Assad, and then Hezbollah in Iran, from Iran. Then Sunnis, Gulf states are all Sunni, then the rebels, and ISIS also. But of course, ISIS is not exactly the friend of everybody else. And so what we find ourselves in is my friend's enemy isn't necessarily my enemy, or my friend's, you know, my enemy's friend isn't exactly. So all of that, all those rules have actually been thrown out of the window. So what we have then ultimately is a civil war with support by others, then a sectarian war, and a proxy war, where you see, you know, United States with Gulf states against Hezbollah, Russia, and Iran. So Iran, a regional power, wants to claim interest in the region. Russia has a long history, in fact, in the Middle East that we tend to forget. And Russia was feeling sidelined more and more, given 10 years of U.S. involvement in Iraq. And so all of these are parties to the conflict. They all have a stake in this. And so what we find ourselves in is, I don't want to call it a mess, but that's what it is. And so it's no longer a conflict where you can say, okay, there's party A and party B, how can we bring them to the negotiating table? How can we see what the positions are and where can we meet in the middle? These are so many different actors with so many different interests and positions that may or may not overlap that it's very difficult to see or to understand what is it that each one of them wants. And some of them obviously don't want to negotiate anyway. So a very difficult situation. Now, the estimate is that there are about 12 big rebel groups. But in fact, another estimate says that there are about over 1,000 smaller ones, smaller groups. So some of them get together and form smaller, like coalition groups, and others operate on their own. And they also change alliances. And so what that means is that when you work as an aid worker in a place like Syria, it means constant negotiations, constantly negotiating access to people in need. And that means that a trip, for example, from Homs, from the border with Turkey to Homs, which is about 300 kilometers, can take days. Because every time you have to negotiate at a new checkpoint. One checkpoint might be ISIS. The next checkpoint might be Jabhat al-Nusra. Then the next checkpoint might be Syrian armed forces. Then another checkpoint might be yet another group. And so it's extremely difficult, and it's very similar probably to what Afghanistan was like in the 80s. As an aid worker, you hope that you can agree on some kind of access rules. So you negotiate with the general and say, I want to have access to your area so I can provide assistance to people in need. That general hopefully will say, I agree. I will pass on the message down the chain of command. What happens in Syria is there's often not a general to negotiate with. And when there is, he might not pass the message down, or his troops don't care. And so it's extremely difficult, not to say dangerous, for aid workers to operate in such an environment, whether they're Syrian or international. Now, what the conflict is also, so it's not just the complexity of the actors, but it's also the complete disregard of what we call the laws of war. So international humanitarian law is basically the framework, the legal framework that governs conflict. It's a legal framework that's been around for 150 years. The Geneva Conventions are the most famous ones. They were codified in 1949 after World War II. And what they're saying basically is that wars cannot be fought in any way a belligerent wants to. There must be rules. A war cannot ignore that there are civilians that need to be respected. And so what international humanitarian law is trying to do is trying to balance military necessity with humanity. So I can't go around killing whoever I want. I can wage war, that's not forbidden, but I have to wage it according to a set of rules. And what's happening in Syria, these rules are basically thrown out of the window. Now, these obligations, they are enshrined in law. It's both states and non-state actors that are obliged to respect them. So just a legal technicality, international law is basically the framework that governs the relationship between states. So a non-state armed group, a rebel group, cannot sign the Geneva Conventions, but they are still bound by them. And so whether a rebel group or the US or Turkey or the Syrian government, when they break these rules, all of them, you know, are making a mistake. All of them are bound by these rules. One important rule is proportionality. What does that mean? It basically means that I cannot use any kind of weapon that I like to achieve my military goal. So I can see that there are two soldiers here. I can't just use a tank to kill them. That's not proportional to the military gain that I'm trying to achieve. Or a village, bombing a village because I think that somebody from that village may have attacked my soldiers. That is disproportionate. So what happens when there's a disproportionate attack is what we call commonly collateral damage. I don't like the word because behind collateral damage there are human beings that should have been protected. But this is ultimately what the result is when you don't respect these rules. Another important principle is distinction. I have to make a distinction between belligerents and civilians. So if you're a soldier and you're a civilian, I am allowed to attack you. I'm not allowed to attack you. That distinction must be made. So it's it is a war crime to attack civilians deliberately or to destroy civilian infrastructure. So attacking hospitals, attacking water supplies, for example, that have no military objective, I'm not allowed to attack those. And that's what's happening every day in Syria. So the medical infrastructure, basically, 60% of Syria's medical infrastructure has been destroyed. This rule, the rule of distinction, has been violated on a daily basis, or is being violated in Syria on a daily basis by all parties to the conflict. With the result that Syria looks today, this is Homs, widespread destruction of the infrastructure. Or it looks like this. This is Homs as well. So a country, Syria used to be a middle-income country. Syria used to have, for many years, a socialist, basically the Ba'ath government is basically a socialist government, very similar to what Iraq was like under Saddam Hussein. Both Syria and Iraq had a very high level of education, a lot of women in quite high positions, very good infrastructure, very good roads. Syria looks like this today, not everywhere, but in a lot of places. Now, the other thing that's happening are sieges. We've heard a lot about sieges, so besieged areas and hard-to-reach areas. And there's often a misunderstanding of what that is. So to besiege an area is not in itself illegal in international humanitarian law. What is illegal is using sieges to starve people, and that's what's happening. So depriving civilians of goods essential to their survival, and willfully withholding humanitarian aid. And that's what's happening in Syria. So many areas are, in fact, not accessible. So Syria, in general, is very difficult to access for aid workers. But it's these areas that are particularly difficult to access. And you may have read accounts of of the Red Cross when they finally got to Madaya, what it took for them to negotiate that. So there's one account of the ICRC where the lady says we had to basically coordinate the convoys to Madaya, so besieged by the government, to another area which was besieged by rebels. And we had to do that simultaneously on the radio, making sure, because that was the deal, we had to deliver to both areas at the same time. That's what the reality is like for civilians in Syria today. Now, quite often, when we speak about Syria, unfortunately, and we spoke about this before, when we look at the news, it's very often dominated by ISIS. It's dominated by the brutality of that group, and rightly so. But I find that it tends to overshadow what Syrians live like every day. And so I'd like to speak a little bit about the effect of conflict on Syrians. And these are just a few numbers. And again, they obstruct the human beings behind them. But what we have today is 13.5 million people in need of humanitarian assistance. 6.5 million of those in need are internally displaced. And so just another legal term, well, it's actually not, but a refugee is somebody who leaves their own country and crosses an international border. Internally displaced are those who are displaced, forcibly displaced in their own country. Near 4.6 million almost Syrian refugees in neighboring countries, and then 8.1 million children in need, of which 2.1 are refugees. Over a quarter of a million people killed. That's 5 years into the conflict. And so what is life like in Syria today? It was interesting. I traveled to Turkey to do the research that Romy mentioned and went to Gaziantep, which is not very far from the Syrian border in the south of Turkey. And I met a medical student, about 25. He said he was in his third year of medical school when the conflict started. And because a lot of the hospitals have been bombed, a lot of the medical personnel have been targeted, arrested, detained, killed. A lot of them have, those who can, at times, just leave. So there aren't a lot of doctors around. And this young medical student told me that he was actually operating on people or performing operations, surgical operations, that he shouldn't in third year as a medical student. But because there were no doctors around, he had to do that. And so he was learning on the job. People are displaced, some of them multiple times. So you have to imagine what that's like. A family leaves, for example, from Raqqa, goes to Aleppo, then Aleppo gets bombed. They try to go to Homs, that gets bombed. Then they might try to get to the border with Jordan, and then finally they reach Jordan. So there's this multiple layers of displacement. People don't just leave their place of origin and go to a place and are safe. They might not be safe there. They might have to go again somewhere else, seek safety somewhere else. It's very disruptive. It's very traumatizing. Fuel has become extremely expensive, and so has food. 5,000 schools are no longer functioning. So we've got a whole generation of children out of school with all the consequences that will bring further down the road. There are certain areas that might be not as affected as others, but not a lot of people, not a lot of places are left that are like that. And most Syrians, when you speak to them, have had some kind of loss in their family or within their or amongst their relatives. Damascus has for a long time been spared the violence, but increasingly the conflict is coming closer and closer. Damascus is pretty much under siege as well. So there are three main roads out: one that goes to Beirut, one that goes to the airport, and one that goes to Homs. But the conflict is coming closer to Damascus every day. Living standards have collapsed. As I said, Syria used to be a middle-income country, a relatively wealthy country. People are very well educated. A doctor's salary is approximately $150 a month. That was a good income before the conflict. Now the Syrian pound has dropped dramatically in value, and today that doesn't buy a lot. There's a basic services are in a state of collapse. So daily life can be very grinding. So people might not necessarily be affected directly by the conflict, as in bombs falling, although many are. But life is just a grinding exercise in trying to survive. What's the aid response been like? There has been a lot of criticism of the aid response, but I feel very strongly about having to point out that aid isn't the solution to a conflict. And unfortunately, because of the inability of political leaders to find a political solution, they put a lot of expectations on humanitarian aid. But humanitarian aid can only ever be a short-term relief in suffering, but it can never solve the conflict. But it's true that from the beginning, access has been very difficult, especially for international agencies. So the UN has struggled to get access, even the ICRC and other organizations as well. And in fact, what we found is that Syrian organizations, so Syrian diaspora organizations, and I understand next week you will have somebody, or in the weeks to come, somebody from a Syrian diaspora organizations, they have in fact filled the gap that international organizations have left because they don't have access. So these Syrian organizations, they have contacts. Many of them might have grown up in England, but they have contacts back in Homs, in Aleppo, in Damascus. They have the contacts, they've got the network, they know the language, and they are able to provide on a much smaller scale, but not on an unimportant scale, aid into areas that are inaccessible to international actors. So these local organizations have access, but they also have to do compromises. A war is always a messy environment to operate in. You have to make compromises, and you have to decide what is the compromise that I will make in order to provide assistance. A lot of discussions have now centered around airdrops, whether that might be a solution. I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced because you have to have a lot of you have to have certain rules around airdrops. So just the safety of people on the ground. Airdrops are a bit easier to do in Sudan, southern Sudan. No cities. It's plain. You can drop the food and people will pick it up. Syria is a very urban environment, is a mountainous environment as well. How do you drop without actually injuring people on the ground? Then also you have to organize the distributions on the ground. Quite often what we've seen in other places when you do food distribution, it can get quite chaotic. People are desperate. And you have to organize, you know, you have to make sure that the weakest ones don't miss out. And so all of that, so it might be a short-term solution, but it might not be it's certainly not a long-term solution. Now, what about the refugee crisis? So over 4.59 million people are today considered refugees. Most of them have fled to Lebanon and Turkey. This has been less of a problem in Turkey, which is relatively wealthy. It's well organized. The camps there are very well organized. It has posed a lot more problems in Lebanon. Lebanon, as you know, has suffered 15 years of civil war between 1975 and 1990. Since then, it tried to recover from that, but has struggled to actually put a government in place. Lebanon's population, if I'm not mistaken, is now 20% Syrian refugees. And so an economy that's already fragile is now having to pick up, in fact, a lot more people to cater for. A lot of discussions center around how can we help Syrian refugees, not just in the immediate future, but long term, because the likelihood of this conflict ending is small right now. And even if the conflict ended tomorrow, people wouldn't be able to go back. I mean, you remember that picture. People can't go back to ruins. And so the likelihood that people will remain somewhere other than Syria is quite high. So you have to find a way to give them, to help them build their resilience. And Turkey has recently, in fact, in January, introduced a new scheme where it will give work permits to Syrian refugees. Jordan is thinking about that. It's not an easy decision to make, and it's very it's quite often unpopular with its own, with your own population, when you say there's already a burden on basic basic services and we're giving them work permits. You know, that's something that's not easy to do for a country. But Turkey has done that, and I think it will help it will help Syrians to find jobs and at least make a living. The worst thing, a refugee, once you're in safety, that's the first thing. But then, you know, what does your future look like? You can't work. Your kids can't go to school. What's happening in Jordan, for example, increasingly families are sending their children to school because they're hoping that the authorities won't send them back to Syria when they get picked up. So what you have, since the beginning of the conflict, an increase in child labor and an increase in child marriages, because families feel like they can't take care of the children, so they'd rather marry them off. What we have also is protracted displacement. Like I said, today, statistically speaking, somebody who is displaced will remain so for a number of years. And that's not entirely new. Let's remember World War II, how long people remained displaced, how many years until people were actually able to return home. But it is true that today's conflicts last much longer than they used to. And so what it means is that a person doesn't just get displaced and can return in a few months' time, they actually remain displaced for a number of years. And that means that aid agencies need to cater for that. It means that policymakers need to cater for that. So what's the outlook? A political solution for Syria, for the time being, I'm not very optimistic. There are no easy solutions to the conflict. I wish there were, that there aren't. But it cannot continue like this. And I'm hoping that politicians, those in power, will see that more people have, a quarter of a million of people killed. This cannot continue like this. There must be better respect for international humanitarian law. There must also be a more coherent approach to the migration issue by the European Union, for example. So policies with regards to migration have been very ad hoc, not just now, but for many years. It's not an easy subject to discuss. It's not easy to find solutions. But the EU, in particular, needs to have a more coherent migration response. There needs to be more political effort to resolve the conflict. And what also needs to change, not just more money, and the pledging conference 2 weeks ago was very important because it did, you know, more money was pledged, but it also means that certain rules have to change. For example, for the time being, overseas development aid cannot be given to a middle-income country. And a middle-income country like Jordan would not technically benefit from that kind of aid. It would benefit from a different kind of aid. And so these rules need to be need to be made a bit more flexible. So that's a bit the outlook. And yeah, I hope I've covered a few of the subjects that you might be interested in. Thank you very much.
Syrians.